Well, let's now turn to the very latest on the conflict in Ukraine. Russian troops have now taken Europe's largest nuclear power plant hours after rocket attacks sparked a fire at the site. That sent alarms across the world about a potential nuclear disaster overnight. Now, firefighters have extinguished the flames, but Ukrainian officials say several people were killed in the attack. Russian forces continue to advance in southern Ukraine, with Kherson now firmly in their control. The military has its sights set on Mykolaiv in an attempt to take control of the coast along the Black Sea. Over in Brussels, NATO members today rejected Ukrainian calls for a no-fly zone over their airspace, saying the alliance is not a part of this conflict. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg stressing that NATO is a defensive military alliance. Take a listen.
And of course, the only way to implement a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes, fighter planes, into Ukrainian airspace and then impose that no-fly zone by shooting down Russian planes. And our assessment is that we understand the desperation, but we also believe that if we did that, we'll end up with something that could end in a full-fledged war in Europe involving many more countries and causing much more human suffering.
EU members are now considering additional sanctions, including cutting more Russian banks out of the SWIFT financial payment system. Let's bring in our guest, Brian Whitmore, Atlantic Council Eurasia Center, non-resident senior fellow. And Brian, I think a lot of people are trying to process what played out, at least overnight here in the U.S. with that attack on the nuclear power plant. What does that tell you in terms of the strategy for Vladimir Putin and how far he's willing to go in this conflict?
Thank you, Akika. It tells me that Vladimir Putin is willing to escalate this conflict. If he's willing to try to risk a nuclear disaster by taking a nuclear power plant, I'm expecting Mr. Putin to only escalate farther. He's been genuinely surprised by the fierce resistance that the Ukrainian armed forces and Ukrainian citizens have put up. This should not have come as a surprise to him. Anybody that knows that country knows that Ukrainians are fiercely patriotic and we're going to fight for their independence and their sovereignty. But nevertheless, the Putin is increasingly frustrated and he's going to be resorting to increasingly aggressive tactics. I expect carpet bombings of major cities, including Kyiv and Kharkiv. And then I think we're looking at a long protracted war here.
What do you see as a possible resolution here? I mean, there were discussions last week that maybe China was going to try to broker a conversation. We know that there was a meeting in Belarus between Russia and Ukraine that didn't yield anything. I mean, what could bring both these parties back to the negotiating table, or do you really not see any sort of short-term resolution here?
Well, Brian, this is the issue. This is the problem. I mean, myself and a lot of other analysts that have been following this, it's hard to imagine the end game here because Putin believes he is on a messianic mission to put pieces of the Soviet Union back together again. There isn't really a compromise to broker here. Either Ukraine is going to be a sovereign independent state or it's not. So every time there is talk of negotiations, I have a problem envisioning a negotiated settlement here. I don't see what that could possibly be. Putin wants Ukraine back under his thumb or under Russia's thumb, and Ukraine wants to remain an independent country. I don't see a middle ground there.
But is it ultimately about regime change? Is it about securing that coast along the Black Sea, which is strategically important for Russia? Or is it about taking all of Ukraine?
Well, I mean, the ultimate goal is regime change. The ultimate goal, and Putin has not really kept this ambiguous. The ultimate goal is to overthrow the Volodymyr Zelensky's government in Kyiv and put a pro-Moscow puppet government in place. The problem with that is that government is not going to last an hour without a Russian occupation to prop it up. And you're going to need troops in Ukraine in order of magnitude much higher than they already have there now in order to prop up a pro-Russian government. So regardless of how this plays out, even if Russia is successful, yes, seizing the Black Sea coast is a tactic toward that aim of overthrowing the government in Kyiv. But even if Russia is successful, we're looking at a, because the Ukrainian insurgency is going to continue. As I said, Ukrainians are fiercely patriotic, tough and resilient, and they're going to fight for their country until the last Ukrainian is standing. And so even if Russia is successful, we're looking at a protracted insurgency that could last for years.
So when we talk about the economic sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, I mean, how long can they keep this going? They only have so much money they can burn through to not only actually finance the operations here that they're doing in Ukraine, but also just to defend their own ruble. Do you see the West as having used up all of its bullets in terms of clamping down economically on Russia, or do you see them kind of capitulating sometime soon?
Well, Brian, you hit on the central issue here. We're kind of in a race against time. Can the Ukrainians hold out long enough for the sanctions to really start to bite, where they begin to threaten Vladimir Putin's ability to wage war and ultimately possibly his rule? We still have a little bit we can ratchet up on. We have not imposed energy sanctions for very obvious reasons. The effect those are going to have on the world market, the effect they're going to have on European supply. So that's one area where we could still escalate on the sanctions. More banks could be added excluded from the SWIFT payment system. That's another area we can escalate. Another is putting more banks on Treasury's SDN sanctions list. There's several banks replaced on the SDN sanctions list. More can be placed on the SDN sanctions list. So there is still a little bit of room to escalate. But it's really a race against time right now. Can the Ukrainians hold out long enough for those sanctions to really begin to bite and really begin to affect the internal domestic political situation in Russia? We're also seeing more opposition inside Russia to this invasion, certainly than I had expected. We're seeing not just protests on the street, but we're seeing senior oligarchs speaking out against the war. Now, I think it's kind of misguided to hope that the oligarchs are somehow going to overthrow Putin. The oligarchs are where they are. They're billionaires because they've been appointed billionaires. It's not like they're an independent force. They are there at the pleasure of Vladimir Putin and can be removed at the pleasure of Vladimir Putin as much. But nevertheless, there can be more pressure on the Russian economy that is going to, you know, hit ordinary Russians in their pockets, that are going to hit the Russian oligarchs in their pockets, and are going to hopefully cause people close to Vladimir Putin to have pause about whether this should be continued. That's really what I'm keeping an eye on right now.
Brian, going back to the military action, though, we're now entering our second weekend since this invasion began. We've been talking about this Russian military convoy that's headed towards Kyiv for many days now. Last we heard yesterday, it was about 18 miles out from the city, but it sounds like that has slowed. What do we read into that? There is so much speculation around why it has taken so long. Is it the equipment? Is it resistance within the military? I mean, what do you read from that advance?
I mean, I think all of those things are possible in terms of why this convoy is slow. I mean, the fact of the matter is we really just don't know, but we could speculate based on the data points that we can see. And there have been reports that Russian soldiers are surrendering en masse and even sabotaging their vehicles to avoid conflict. Remember, these are 18-year-old kids, who some of whom, if you can believe the videos from captured soldiers speaking to Ukrainians, that they didn't even really know they were going into a war. They were told they were having military training exercises. So that's one thing. The other is that the logistics were really poorly planned out. There've been food and fuel shortages. So that seems to be slowing it down. What this convoy illustrates to me is I am literally shocked at the poor performance of the Russian armed forces in this conflict. It's literally shocking. But those are the main data points I see that explain the slowness of this convoy in approaching Kyiv. What they apparently are trying to do here is encircle Kyiv. And that's going to get extremely ugly if they manage to do that. But the fact of the matter is that we're a week in, and Russia's only seized one major city, Kherson. It's remarkable. I would have thought all major cities would have fallen by this point, and they haven't.
Yeah, it seems like the Russians
tribute to the Ukrainian, the fighting spirit of the Ukrainian armed forces.
I was going to say that it seems like they vastly underestimated the power of the Ukrainian forces. But again, Brian Whitmore, Atlantic Council, Eurasia Center, non-resident senior fellow, thanks so much for stopping by Yahoo Finance this morning.